This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks very much indeed, Chris, and good morning, everybody. Very nice to see some familiar faces, but also some new faces here. And I judge from that there are people in the room who will know a lot more, even than me, about some of the stuff I'm about to talk about, because we're living with it every day. But I thought that what I might do to help the discussion along is to start by taking a step back and just reminding ourselves of what's different about the work programme and why it's designed in the way that it is, and talk a little bit about the design as well. And then I'm going to talk towards the end about, it won't be that long, by the way, talk about some of the ways in which we're looking to both track the performance of the work programme, but also to do that in a more transparent way and a more organised way than we've done it in the past, because I think that's one of the important opportunities which we've got collectively in the work programme. So start then with why the work programme is the way it is. Important to remember that this is designed for those who will have spent a lot of time already, in many cases actually quite a fair bit of time in successive phases, trying to get work and not getting work because they have some barriers to work which require more than the attention that Job Centre Plus advisors are able to give them in the early months of a claim. And so the whole ethos of a work programme is about providing a system which enables providers to pull together much more personalised and tailored packages of support for people for whom one size fits all really does not work best. And the corollary of that is that, you know, the old phrase, you don't buy a dog and bark yourself. If we're going to use third-party providers to do that, it's really important that we don't try and second-guess what the design of that support should be. And, you know, I do think that people will look back and say that one of the really significant breakthroughs in the work programme was at last keeping faith with the idea of a black box, that we will reward providers for outcomes, and we will not prescribe how those outcomes should be, and we should be very, very flexible and permissive indeed. Just in the same way, we're trying to allow Job Centre Plus advisors a greater flexibility and discretion than they've had in the past. And, you know, this is a real change. For those of you who are less familiar with our systems, I mean, it is true that in the past, over successive employment programmes, we have paid for process, not for outcomes. We pay for inputs, not for outputs, and as a result of which we've had plenty of process and really not nearly as many outcomes as we should have had. So this is a distinctive step forward. We also believe, and I think there's early signs of this, I think it's going to be true in the ESF programme as well, which people in the room are about to embark on, that by taking this low prescription approach to the design of a programme, we actually help partnership working, because we aren't putting into the system a lot of clutter from central government. We're enabling our providers to work on a more flexible basis with local government, with other actors in the local system. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment as well. So a few facts to build on what the Minister said. It is a very big programme. We will have, for sure, by the end of this business year, well over 600,000 people. I've got 630,000 people. That may even turn out to be an underestimate. By the end of 2012-13, we will be supporting over 1 million people on the work programme. And by the conclusion of these contracts, we reckon that over 2.5 million people will have been through the work programme. So, you know, this is a really, by any standards, this is a significant change, and of course it replaces a whole host of very differentiated, fragmented, complex programmes which between them try to capture the same population for job seekers, didn't really extend into the harder to help groups in the way that the work programme does. Minister talked about being pleased to pay shed loads of money to providers. The great thing about the design of the work programme is that because of the arrangement which we have with the Treasury, in effect, we have uncapped performance from a payment point of view. And this has never been the case in the past. We've always had to work on the basis that if providers did better than was forecast, we would have a problem as a department because we were only able to pay out of our departmental budget. The great thing about the work programme is that as providers hopefully get into more and more areas of performance, taking the harder help groups into work in a way that's never been done before, breaking the performance expectations, the money is there because it's paid for out of benefit savings. And that completely changes the dynamics and the chemistry of the work programme compared with previous activities. There are people in this room who live and breathe this, so I apologise to them. I'm going to talk a little bit about the payment model of the work programme, just so that everybody's clear about some of the distinctive aspects of it. And just to start again with what it's replacing, we had a very complicated setup in the past, but typically we paid on a promise rather than on performance. In other words, a provider would get somebody into work, provide us with evidence that that job was expected to last for a period of time, and we'd make a payment on the basis of that. Under the work programme, that changes in very significant ways, as I'll just demonstrate now. For the first half of the work programme, we do pay an attachment fee, a payment which is available as the provider engages with that work, with that customer, and get that claimant gets them started on the programme. That attachment fee declines year by year and then disappears in the second half of the programme, but it's important in terms of funding the whole system. If you follow the individual through their time on the work programme, and remember they have up to 2 years on the work programme, so much more, double the time that's been there in any programme. So a chance to really work with that individual to give them the support that they need. At some point, hopefully as soon as possible, the provider gets them started on a job. We don't pay them anything at that stage. Important change from the past. A very good one too, Stuart, if I may say so. Then there is a period of, for main job seekers, 26 weeks in employment, not necessarily the same job, but in employment. And at that point, we make a job outcome payment. So already, this is a big change. We're basically saying we're paying for we're paying for work which has been undertaken for a period of 26 weeks. And remember, at this stage, all the evidence shows that if somebody's been in work for 26 weeks, the predictor is very strong that they will become an employed person rather than a continuously unemployed person. So the provider is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that first period, and then we pay them a job outcome payment. But then, and then this is really uncharted territory and very, very significant in terms of policy intent, we're paying the provider the bulk of their money for keeping them in work for a period up to 2 years. It varies for different customer groups, from 1 year to 2 years. So the provider's job is no longer to launch somebody into some sort of work and then get a payment. The provider's job is to get them into work, get them into work and keep them into work for 26 weeks before they get any money, and then to stay in touch with that individual, to work with them so that they become somebody who has got an extended period of employment. And that is very often the life-changing thing which has never really happened in our work programmes before. In our employment programmes, there was this thing called the revolving door, where very often people would get into work for short periods, come back to Job Centre Plus, their skill level didn't go up, their employability didn't really improve. So this is a very, very fundamental point indeed. Just the phrase up there, incentive payments, in the second half of the programme where I think absolutely rightly, again, the stretch goes up as the programme continues because we think that there are efficiencies to be gained through a long contract. There's 7 years worth of work here, paid work for providers. So the price goes down, the unit price goes down. But for those providers who really excel and bust the employment, bust the performance, minimum performance level significantly, the unit price will be enhanced by a bonus payment as well. So the incentive is there. Just to talk about incentives a moment more, if I make a contrast with the past, and I personally felt this as a real difficulty in the past system. Typically, we had in the former sort of patchwork quilt of provision, we didn't really have competition beyond the point of letting tenders. So we had competitive tendering, but then typically, with very few exceptions, we had a single provider covering an area for a particular program or for a particular group. That gave us very little contingency, and it meant that on any one operational day, the burden of opinion internally was, okay, this provider may be underperforming, but if we take them out, it's going to take us 18 months to replace them through some elaborate procurement exercise, so we'll live with it. And we did live with systematic underperformance in a way which we should not have been comfortable with. This changes dramatically with the work program. We have lines of contingency now which make this a much more competitive and incentivized program. In every part of the country, there are two or three in the big urban areas competing prime contractors who are getting, in this first part of the program, an equal share of a business randomly allocated to them by Job Centre Plus advisors. After a couple of years, when performance track record, we will each period of time allocate that market share on a performance-related basis. So the provider in that area who is doing best will get more of the business, and that will be differentiated by the different customer groups as well. And as I said, we will pay bonuses for best performers. We have set a minimum performance level, which is 10% above the do-nothing level, if I can put it that way. So we are able to calculate what the kind of policy off level of job placement will be. We set a minimum performance level for the main job seekers groups, 10% above that. And that is a contractual requirement. So if a provider falls below that, and we'll work with them for a period of time in true performance management style to try and rectify that, but if it looks as if it's a real systematic problem, we'll take the contract away, and we now have the contingency which is provided by a combination of the competition in each area, the existence of work program providers elsewhere in that particular region, and also the framework which we set up, which has, if you like, a bench of pre-qualified providers, potential providers, whom we can contract very quickly in a matter of weeks now rather than 18 months to replace a provider who hasn't been able to perform. So I can tell you, as the commissioner of work program providers, this feels like a very different place to be. And I think on behalf of taxpayers, it's a much, much more defensible place to be than we have in the past. Just want to say a few words about local dimensions. As I mentioned at the beginning, I do think this is going to be absolutely critical to the work programme's success because, again, if I contrast with the past, we've often seen situations where there's actually a multiplicity of provision in areas. Some of it's paid for by us, a lot of it paid for by the old regional development agencies, some of it paid for by local authorities, some by the skills funding agency, a lot of it purporting to do the same thing, all of it carried out under the label of employability support. A hell of a lot of it, it seemed to me, designed to give people forklift truck driver's licenses, which I was never completely convinced was the answer to the unemployment problem, but there you go. Obviously, what did I know? So we think now, I mean, I already see this actually, and although it's early days, I'm mighty encouraged by this. Just the sheer difference it makes in an area the size of Wales or Scotland or west of London or the West Midlands, to have two or three work programme providers able to sit around a table with Job Centre Plus regional director, the leaders of local government or city regions involved, key employers organisations. You know, it's already is beginning to feel like a very, very different terrain, and I think it's got the makings of something very special, actually, a real concerted partnership approach to finding work for people who we haven't succeeded in doing that for in the past. Just a couple of examples, Straws in the Wind, but I think actually, you know, as Chris said, Borrow with Pride on this topic, I think. In Wales, I co-chair a body which brings together the Welsh Assembly Government, UK Government, local government in Wales, voluntary sector, trade unions, the employers' organisations, and those dealing with European Social Fund. So it is kind of a labour market management around one table. We now have, in around that table, the two work programme providers who provide services across the whole of Wales. And on the first meeting we had together, we sent the Job Centre Plus regional director and the two work programme providers off with a remit of drawing up a protocol to ensure that all of the employer engagement activities carried on in Wales were, wherever possible, coordinated. And so we avoided a situation where employers were just getting hounded by a multiplicity of people saying, you know, give us your jobs. I was really impressed with what they came back with. I have to say it exceeded my expectations because I think this is delicate territory. It's a source of competitive advantage for some providers, but they've come back with a really strong protocol, which means that monthly, at every geographical level around a Job Centre Plus district, the providers and Job Centre Plus and relevant people from local government will get together, share data about vacancies on their books and coming up from their main employers, and look to make sure that nobody's sitting on, if you like, a packet of vacancies which are not being serviced by the system. Now, I just think to have got to that point within the first month of a work programme, after I don't know how many conversations we've had about this between us over the course of the last few years, which have got nowhere, is a real sign of what can be achieved on this front. So it gives me a lot of optimism. There's some really interesting stuff happening in London around the Olympics as well, bringing together work programme providers, Job Centre Plus, the Olympic authorities, what can be done to get a really good share of the kind of work experience which is going to come up during the Olympics in classic entry roles in the security sector, in catering, in public relations and so on. So lots of optimism around this stuff, I think. Final area I just want to touch on in terms of the work programme story is that of supply chains. Again, if I take a step back, why is this significant? It matters because if we're trying to create a system in which those who are furthest from the labour market get the best and most tailored packages of support that are relevant to them, we need a system which enables those organisations with all the relevant specialisms to be brought together, get the incentives right, and able to deliver properly. And I know this is a subject which has had a lot of attention, a lot of publicity, I would say a certain amount of urban mythology as well. There are actually over 800 organisations delivering services in the work programme as subcontractors. That's many more organisations actually than we've had in the past. The majority of those come from the voluntary or community sector, although many of them are also SMEs with specialisms in either particular skill areas or to do with condition management, particular health complaints and so on. So we think that's a great start. We're not in the supply chain business, we're in the performance business. So as performance data emerges, as we see who's delivering the best services, I expect that to be a dynamic and flexible picture. And our message to primes is, you know, what we want from you is performance. You have signed up to the Merlin standard, which tells us that you will keep to the promises you have made in the negotiation period with your subcontractors. And if you don't, then you will risk being in breach of contract because of Merlin. However, if you find that a subcontractor is not performing and you're coming to ask them money to change your supply chain arrangements with a better performer, we'll have that conversation. Performance comes top on that count. Now, Actually, in all, we've looked at this very carefully. We've had an independent look at it as well. I am very pleased that there is a lot of stability in the supply chain arrangements which were shown to us during the contracting period. Very little churn at the moment. Where there have been changes, they're for very understandable, legitimate business reasons on both sides. And there is no evidence that the prime contractors in the work programme are behaving in ways which are at odds with our Merlin standard, which sets out very clearly the behaviours and standards which we expect in supply chain management. So we think that that's a really good start. We're conscious that the position of some of the specialist contractors will be very dependent on the flow of business through the work programme, and we are very actively looking to make sure that the mix of claimants going on to the work programme reflects the policy intent of support which we're setting out to give through it. So the last few minutes for me, I just want to say a little bit about how our approach to monitoring performance is changing as a result of the work programme. I'm going to start by an anecdote. It is true, when I came into this job just over 4 years ago now, I was trying to make sense of what all these employment programmes were, and it took me a bit of time, I can tell you. One question I asked, and I was almost embarrassed to ask it because it felt like such a stupid question, was, what is the definition of a job outcome? And people around the table went, well, it's not as simple as that. So I asked just for, on one side of paper, could somebody just set out how many different job outcome definitions we had? Well, we got to 13 and we stopped counting. I start from that point of view because under that circumstance, with that, in that past system, it was absolutely impossible to get a really credible story about performance and performance comparisons told. Added to which, the sort of benchmark that people tended to use was how are providers doing against their profile of performance that they promised in their bids. Well, if you think about it, that's a pretty bonkers approach to performance measurement and management. So you're measuring performance against a promise. Well, that doesn't really do it for me, actually. I'd like to see performance against actuals. And we were never really in that position because we didn't have the data, we didn't have comparative definitions, programs have been led at different times, overlapping customer groups, and so on. The work program, kind of almost with one leap, does get us out of all of that. And it's terribly important because this is the opportunity that we have collectively to demonstrate that the spending of government money in this way is value for money for the taxpayer and delivers results for those who need the services. And actually, I'm not comfortable that we've ever really been able to demonstrate that collectively and decisively in the past. Under the work programme, there really is no hiding place because we have very simple metrics. We have the minimum performance levels, which are all based around a very simple calculation. What proportion of the people referred to a provider get a job and stay in a job? Now, that's a lot better to me than 13 competing definitions of job outcomes. That's clear, simple. It will be transparent. Once we get to a point where we've got a proper flow of information, because remember, people go onto a work programme, they stay there for 2 years. So actually getting to a point where we say, okay, now we can take a meaningful and officially measurable definition of performance. That will be out there, published every quarter. You'll be able to look at how each of the providers are doing in each of the contract package areas. If providers want to start doing the same for their subcontractors, I think that might be kind of interesting too. Transparency is the key to proving that this is the right policy and proving that the right people have the contracts at the right time. We're going to be tracking that, and as we develop this performance framework, we will be making this public as well. Trying to take a bit of a balanced business scorecard view of this, distinguishing between those things which are common across all employment programs and actually which relate to some of the things which we do. So some of the enablers are about our skills as commissioners and performance managers, our performance as performance managers, if you like. Then there are really clear domains of employment. I've got a snazzy slide here, which I probably won't be able to. I'll just put it all up, actually. I can never do these things. I'm not sure it's... So enablers, so some of the things which we do to assure that the systems that providers are using are sound and secure, that information security is there, so that claimant data is being respected and all the rest of it. And then domains of performance, which will include not just classic output information, but expenditure and value for money, customer experience, what's the level of customer complaints, what's the proportion of those customer complaints that were upheld, what are some of the softer customer feedback around the work programme, we will be tracking that. Supply chain strength, so what's coming out of the Merlin standard and its use and so on. So for the first time, we really have got a chance to tell a joined up story about this whole area of work, this whole industry, and what's happening to the people who go through it. And I think in this age of greater transparency, that's a key part of the story as well. Kirsty, I'm very conscious that you're a strict time.
Fine,
keeper.
Actually, Alan, you're fine.
But I am going to stop there, actually. So very happy to pick up anything else, by the way.
Thanks very much indeed.